This is Charlottesville Tomorrow. Charlottesville Tomorrow is a nonprofit organization engaging the public on critical quality of life issues so we make informed choices for our community's future. Visit us on the web at seavilletomorrow.org. On October 7, 2015, Charlottesville Tomorrow and the Daily Progress co-sponsored a candidate forum for the two people seeking election to the Whitehall seat on the Albemarle County School Board. The candidates are Carol C.J. Hatcher and David Oberg. This is an open seat race with two newcomers vying for the public's vote. Five of the seven seats on the board will be on the ballot on November 3rd. Good evening. My name is Brian Wheeler. I'm Executive Director of Charlottesville Tomorrow. I want to welcome you to Henley Middle School for this candidate forum. This evening we're co-hosting, along with the Daily Progress, the candidate forum for these two people seeking election to the Whitehall seat on the Albemarle County School Board. We have Carol C.J. Hatcher and David Oberg. This is an open seat race, so as far as politics go, these are two newcomers. Vying for your votes. Five of the seven seats on the school board will be on the ballot November 3rd. The other contested races are for the at-large seat and the Samuel Miller district. Incumbents are running unopposed in the Scottsville and Ravana districts. Now, before I tell you about the format for tonight's forum, I want to make sure you know about Charlottesville Tomorrow and the Daily Progress. Some of you are regulars at these, so I apologize that you're hearing it again, but repetition's the mother of learning, so we'll keep giving you the commercial here. Charlottesville Tomorrow believes informed citizens create better communities. We are a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization, and we do not endorse any candidates. Our goal is to help you make an informed choice on issues primarily related to land use, transportation, public education, and community design. Tonight, we'd like to get you on our email list if you're not on there already. We've got a sign-up sheet on the table as you came in. I'm pleased to be joined by our co-moderator in the back of the room, Nick Matthews, who's the managing editor of the Daily Progress. So if you want to learn about the Daily Progress, you can talk to Nick afterwards. Our partnership with the newspaper goes back to 2009, and our two organizations collaborate in many ways. Charlottesville Tomorrow's contribution has been over 1,600 news stories, published both online and in the newspaper over the past 6 years. The newspaper contributes in many ways. A very important one is the printing and layout of this voter guide. Now, this is the 2013 voter guide, but the 2015 guide is being laid out right now for Albemarle County. There's a version of the Charlottesville one. You can see it's really happening in the back there. So the newspaper is laying out and printing these voter guides. These are produced in partnership with the League of Women Voters. We're very appreciative of the League's support on that, both financially and with the information they provide. And then we also have this year Blue Ridge Bank is our corporate sponsor for the voter guides. That will be mailed first class to every household in Albemarle County. So every voter will get one of these voter guides. We'll cover all the school board races and board of supervisor races. I think the community is very lucky to have a newspaper like the Daily Progress that's supportive of such innovative partnerships with a nonprofit like Charlottesville Tomorrow, and I think we all benefit from having that additional civic media available to the community. Now, let's get to the business at hand, talk about the format. To help keep us on schedule, I hope everyone in the audience will be respectful of all the candidates. I do ask that you remain quiet throughout the forum and that you hold your applause to the end. Tonight, the candidates will begin by introducing themselves to you with an opening statement. Then they will respond to five questions that Charlottesville Tomorrow and the Daily Progress have come up with, and all candidates will be asked all the same questions throughout the whole night. Next, the candidates will address your questions. We've got cards and pens in the back. We'd love to get your ideas about what you want to have the candidates ask about in the second half of the forum. After that, because we have two candidates, we can do something a little more fun. The candidates will get to ask each other questions. So each candidate will get to ask the other two questions, and we'll see what they want to know about each other. And maybe by the time you get there, you'll feel like you know everything there is to know about each other. You won't know what to ask. Throughout the forum, I will announce how much time the candidates have for their responses. Jerry Krueger is with us tonight from the League of Women Voters, another great nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that can help you with all things related to the election. Jerry will hold up a yellow card indicating that there's 30 seconds left, and the red card will indicate the candidates must wrap up quickly. We expect the forum to run until about 8 o'clock, 8:15. Finally, our goal is to help you make an informed choice, but if your question is not addressed tonight, I hope you'll approach the candidates directly. That's a great thing about local government is these candidates are all very accessible to the voters and are happy to answer your questions. So I would encourage you to chat them up directly if you need more information. And with that, I'll remind the audience and our candidates to everybody, silence your mobile phones so we don't get interrupted that way. And each candidate will get 3 minutes for an opening statement. And based on where they are seating, Mr. Oberg will go first. So, Dave, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you. I'm going to move this, if that's okay. I want to thank all of you for coming. I want to thank Charlottesville Tomorrow and the Daily Progress for hosting this. I think this kind of thing in a small town is awesome. I think it's great that people are out. I'm very proud of CJ and I because we got more people out here than the at-large, Jono and Catherine. People have asked me a number of times, why am I running? And I'm going to point out the reason I'm running. Kendra, stand up. I like to pick on my daughter. My daughter is a sixth grader here at Henley Middle School. She's the one who showed me where the debate's going to be tonight. I am so proud of her. She went to kindergarten at the Methodist Church here in Crozet, or preschool at the Methodist Church, and then went to kindergarten through fifth grade at Crozet Elementary. And she's the reason I'm running. I'm passionate about education. I live sort of the American success story. My grandfather had a grade school education. That's all he got to, and he had to go to work. And he worked very hard, and he managed to send my father's the first member of the family, and he was the seventh youngest of the family. My father's first Oberg to go to college. And he graduated from college, and he put me through public school in rural Alaska, and I had a full-ride scholarship to Washington University in St. Louis. And I graduated from near the top of my class at Cornell Law School. I've been a lawyer for 20 years. And to me, that is the American success story. That's what makes us exceptional as a country. Other countries have public education, but public education in those countries doesn't allow them to succeed across generations like I see. In two generations, we went from being effectively dirt farmers. I'm an attorney. And to me, that's what America is about. I want every child to have that same opportunity. I want every child to have the blessings that Kendra has. I specifically chose Crozet. I picked my house in Laurel Hills because I figured there was no chance in the world that could be redistricted from Crozet Elementary. Ironically, 5-6 years later, we're right back where we were before with redistricting, and parents are having to make the same decisions and have the same agonization that we had at that time. I believe in a budget that's based upon needs-based budgeting. I believe that high-stakes testing are a huge mistake, and if I'm elected to the school board, I will fight every day to make sure that they don't use high-stakes testing to evaluate my child, the other students, the teachers in the school system, and they don't evaluate our schools. And I believe that every child should be given the same option and the opportunity to succeed. And part of that means pre-K education for every single child. I hope you will vote for me. The election's November 3rd. And again, I really thank the fact that you all came out today. I think it's awesome. And I want to thank CJ for coming, too. It's great that we have an election. So thank you.
Thank you. Can everyone hear okay? Yep. Okay.
Okay. Thanks, David. And I want to thank everybody for coming, too. And, of course, the Charlottesville Tomorrow and the Daily Progress. A lot of you who are here know me, but I'm always asked the question, what does CJ stand for? My full name is Carol Jordan Hatcher, and I go by CJ. And that came about kind of crazy, and we'll get into that later maybe. But I was born in Texas, but I love to tell people I'm a Virginian by choice. I've lived all over the United States, and I mean from one end to the other, Pennsylvania to Seattle, and south to Las Vegas, Texas, and everywhere in between. But it's hard to find a county or an area more promising than Albemarle County. And so I'm just thrilled to be here. When my late husband retired, we chose to live in Albemarle County so that we could be near our son and his family. That's what we tell them. But the big draw was the grandkids, you know, son and daughter-in-law. Well, but anyway, they attend Albemarle schools, and they're older now. When we first moved here, they were just in elementary school. They needed a lot of help from us. But now that they're older, they're both in high school. They're both at Albemarle Senior. And I thought, how could I help them? I could help them best maybe by running for school board. I'm concerned about students today, and I'm concerned about our future generations. We have got to do something for these kids because they are our greatest resource. I've spent my entire career in education. I was a high school teacher for 10 years, and so I've been in the trenches. I understand what goes on in the classroom. Later, I took a job as the director of education for a media company, and I had an administrative role there with employees, budgets. I was responsible for major educational projects that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. And one thing that I pride myself on is I developed a lot of business school partnerships where we got the community to pay big bucks, sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars, for programs and projects. For example, similar to what we have at Albemarle High School, the Mesa Academy, that was fully funded by a business. And so none of that money had to come out of the school board budget, and so that was a good thing. Okay, after that, I started my own business, and I was in that business for 25 years, educational publishing. We created supplemental materials for the classroom, and the thought behind that was textbooks, heck, they were out of date before they were even printed, some of them. And so they needed, you know, teachers needed real-life learning help and supplementals, and so that was the idea behind the company. And I was successful at that. Personally, I've authored 33 books. I was appointed to a policy-level position by Governor Kenny Gwynn in Nevada when I lived there. So I've had that policy role, too. In recent years, I was a columnist for the Washington Examiner, where I wrote a higher education series. So I feel like I'm qualified in every area, and as a teacher, as an administrator, and as a policymaker, I've done it all.
Thank you. Thank you. All right, we're going to go to the five questions from the Daily Progress in Charlottesville tomorrow. I want you to be thinking about the questions you want to ask, and you can turn those in on index cards. The first question will go to Ms. Hatcher. You'll have 2 minutes to respond to everything from this point on until the closing statements. The topic is standardized testing, and here's the question. Mandated by the state in order to comply with federal law, each year, many Albemarle students take standards of learning exams. Please describe the role you think standardized testing should play in education. Ms. Hatcher.
Okay, I think achievement is very, very important. We've got to reach for the stars. Our kids have got to reach as high as they can reach. So in doing so, you know, it's so important to be able to evaluate or test or measure how much they've achieved. I do not think the SOL should be our only form of measurement. It seems that too much, we put too much emphasis on one or in other states and standardized test. It's not fair to some students, and it's not fair to evaluate the students, the teacher, and the school district completely on this one test. Kids test differently. I would be up for testing in a variety of ways. I think we could do practicums. We could do a lot of hands-on things. I think too often we get all wrapped up in, oh my gosh, you know, got to teach to the test. The test is coming. We got to get our kids ready. If we would teach and allow those teachers to do creative things in their classroom, and who knows what they would do, because we have some of the best teachers at Albemarle. But do these creative things in the classroom, and in that way you're teaching the skills. Well, if the students learn the skills, they can pass any test. They could pass this test. In my day, we were always compared to the Iowa kids, you know, Iowa standards. I don't even know if they have that anymore. But, we need to evaluate, but that should not be the only way, and we should not, we should just not bet on the farm when it comes to just one standardized test. It's just not right.
Thank you. Mr. Oberg, mandated by the state in order to comply with federal law, each year many Albemarle students take standards of learning exams. Please describe the role you think standardized testing should play in education. Mr. Oberg.
Standardized testing is a fact of life in education. I took SRAs when I was a kid. But the SRA tests were designed as a diagnostic for use by the educators to determine where they can focus with individual children, what children are succeeding on specific topics, and how to focus their energies. No Child Left Behind, and I don't blame President Bush. I think his heart was in the right place, and I think Laura Bush, absolutely, her heart was in the right place. They said, we need to make sure that every child is succeeding. And so they created high-stakes testing. They took what were diagnostics tests, and they said, okay, we're gonna grade students, we're going to grade schools, and we're going to grade specific teachers based upon how they do these tests. Well, the tests weren't designed to gauge that, and so they quickly figured out that that was a disaster. There was a big movement to change it, and when President Obama got elected, unfortunately, he replaced it, but he replaced it with something that's far worse, the Race to the Top program. And the high-stakes testing has become more and more egregious and problematic. I swore to my elementary school principal, Karen Marcus, my child was not going to take the SOLs when she got to third grade, because I don't think they're an effective measure, and I've seen third and fifth graders getting sick to their stomachs because of these tests, and that's insane. In my opinion, no third grader should be afraid to go to school because of a test, and yet that's what was taking place. And so I swore to my principal, she's not going to take them. And then I met her teachers, and I realized that her teachers were going to be evaluated and graded based upon how Kendra took the test, and if she chose not to take the test, they get a zero. That's wrong, and I will fight tooth and nail to defeat that.
Thank you. All right. Second question will go first to Mr. Oberg. And the topic is recurring budget challenges. Before a balanced budget is ultimately adopted by the school board, the public is often told in the budget planning stage that there's a multi-million-dollar deficit. The funding gap today is estimated to be $6.4 million for next year's budget. If you are elected, what will you tell the public and the Board of Supervisors that you will do about this challenge? Mr. Oberg.
Okay. The first step is understanding where that budget gap comes from. And in 2008 and 2009, when the complete market collapsed, there were deficits everywhere. And the state government was placed in a position where they had to cut funds. And I don't fault the governor or the delegate assembly for doing that at that time. It was necessary. We just didn't have the money. But when we had those discussions with the General Assembly, we said, but when the economy turns around, please put that money back. And we were guaranteed by the governor, by the Senate, and the delegates that they would put that money back. But they never did. And as the economy improved, they just kept that money out of education. And I saw one of the delegates in the Seville Weekly was bragging about the fact they had a $515 million budget surplus. Well, that's not a budget surplus. That's money they took out of education and never put back. Right now, we're educating our children with $600 less per student than we did in 2009. That impacts us. And if you look at what, if they had simply funded at 2005 level, we would have an additional $8 million from the state. So not only would we not have a budget deficit, we would have a surplus of $2 million. And so my first step is I would tell the parents and the public, we need to get on the delegate assembly, we need to get on the senators, talk to Cray Deed, talk to Rob Bell, and get them to fund education fully like they said that they would. The second thing I would say is there is nothing more valuable in our community than our schools. We spend more money per prisoner on prisoners in jail in Virginia than we do on students. And if it costs more money, I will go and I will fight to make sure the money gets funded so our children have every opportunity to succeed.
Thank you. Ms. Hatcher, I'll repeat the question throughout the evening. Before a balanced budget is ultimately adopted by the school board, the public is often told in the budget planning stage that there is a multi-million-dollar deficit. The funding gap today is estimated to be $6.4 million for next year's budget. If you are elected, what will you tell the public and the Board of Supervisors that you will do about this challenge? Ms. Hatcher?
Well, the German in me, reality, David is totally correct, but reality is we don't have that money from the state. Who knows if we're going to get it? And we have what we have. And so I think one place we need to start is when the budget is presented to the Board of Supervisors. We need full transparency. Also present the budget to the supervisors in such a way that they understand. Make this more of a line item situation. We need this program and this project for this school to be used in this way and so on. And I don't think all schools should be equal. We need to fund the programs and the projects that, that are requested, and are working wonderfully at that school. We need to work with that school to get the funding for that project. We need to be more judicious in our spending because, like I said, we might not be getting any more money. So we need to be a whole lot more judicious in our spending. We always need to look for get more bang for our buck. Higher amounts should always be spent on the classroom, the teachers, and the students. I'm all for reviewing some of these programs and projects, and I understand that Pam Moran is starting to do that. Let's review the projects and throw out the ones that are not no longer make any sense or not necessary or not doing what they were designed to do in the first place. We need to make sure that money, the little money we have, or the big money that we have, is spent in a much more judicious way and equitable by program. Maybe not, every elementary school should get X amount. Well, no. Some of them might have the special needs programs at their school, and they might need more. Some might have other programs.
Thank you. All right, the third question. We'll start with you, Ms. Hatcher. The topic is early childhood education. The Albemarle School Board has primarily focused its resources on grades K through 12, while local government has provided the oversight and majority of funding for pre-K. Do you support the separation of responsibilities and ownership of early childhood education? Why or why not? Ms. Hatcher.
I do. I think the program that we have right now, the Bright Stars program, is a program that we should continue to fund. I think it works great. There's a need for that program. There are families that are in Albemarle County that have a need. They have financial needs. They have needs for their children to be learning ready and that sort of thing. But we were talking about the budget a minute ago. We are doing well with this program. I know there's a waiting list. But I do not think that we are ready or even should consider universal pre-K across the board for our schools today. We've got to remember that learning begins at first with the family. And I know we've talked about there's those families that don't even have a book in the house. They don't have magazines. They don't even have parents that are home. Well, those are the families that should be on the list for the pre-K program that's already working and it's working well in Albemarle County, which is a Bright Stars. I think maybe we need to look into it for future, but right now I think we should just keep it as it is.
Thank you. Mr. Oberg, the Albemarle School Board has primarily focused its resources on grades K through 12, while local government has provided the oversight and majority funding for pre-K. Do you support the separation of responsibilities and ownership of early childhood education? Why or why not?
I don't, Brian. And the reason being, and I quite frankly think it's sort of a budgetary game, because the Board of Supervisors is paying for the whole budget either way. Okay, they control this issue because it makes it look like the education system is taking less than they would otherwise take. I believe in universal pre-K. And the reason I believe in that is that our studies show, fairly affirmatively, that if children show up at kindergarten and they can recognize letters and they know how books work and they know their numbers, they will much quicker be successful in reading. And if you are not at grade level reading at third grade, your success rate in our academics and in our society plummets. The reality is our teachers have a 4-year window right now to get kids where they need to be. And one of the great diagnostic differences is the kids, and CJ's right, parents who read to their children. I read to my child when she was prenatal. I read to her in her mother's belly. And I kind of thought that was nuts, but my wife said, no, it's important. You need to bond with a baby. And last night at a PTO meeting, my daughter was carrying around a book like this. And I don't think that's coincidental. But not every parent has the opportunity. We have parents in our communities that are working 2 and 3 jobs. I was fortunate. I could spend the time every night to read to her. I still read to her every night. Not every parent has that chance. And so we have kids coming into our kindergartens who not only don't they know the letters, they don't know how books work. They don't understand the phonetics that words in the books relate to sounds. And from my perspective, if we don't pay for those programs now, if we don't support those children now when they need it, we are going to pay for them in the future. The cost per prisoner in Virginia is higher than the amount that we pay per student. And we should pay to make sure those children have every chance.
Thank you. All right, I've got 2 more questions. Then we're going to take your questions. So if you have them, you can hold them up. If you need a card, you can wave your hand, and Dan right here will help you out. We're going to take the top 6 questions as determined by Nick Matthews from the Daily Progress. So know that they're being screened, and we're picking what we think would be the best ones to help differentiate the candidates. All right. The 4th question will go first to Mr. Oberg. The topic's world languages. Would you support a budget initiative to expand world language instruction in the elementary schools? Why or why not?
This is not a clear answer. I'm going to say yes, maybe, maybe not. Okay. I think world languages are very important, and I think what's taking place at Cale is great. I would not support at this point an immersion program in every elementary school because I don't think we're ready for it. It is expensive, and I think there's great returns on it. But what's taking place at Cale, they have 300 students in the foreign language program. Half of those are in an immersion program where 50% of the instruction is in Spanish. And half of those students are native Spanish-speaking people. That makes a certain level of sense to me. But when you have half the children are taking what is effectively an elective, I support that. I think that's great. But right now, we don't have teachers in every school who could teach those programs. And I think it's something we should work towards. But I also think that there is a problem because you're going to have kids who are, right now, the program at Cale is between kindergarten and 3rd grade. You're going to have to extend that to 5th grade. What happens when those kids get to middle school and there's no program to sustain that education? Our kids are going to get to middle school and to high school, and the programs aren't there to continue. And so if you're going to make it successful, you have to be prepared from a budgeting standpoint to not only fund elementary foreign languages, but to fund it for 13 years. And at this point, I don't think we have the money to do it. I think it's something we should work for as an elective, and I think the elective program at Cale, we could institute elsewhere. But I don't think the immersion program, as much as I love it, I think it's great. I don't think we're ready to do that in Albemarle County at this point.
Thank you. Ms. Hatcher, would you support a budget initiative to expand world language instruction in the elementary schools? Why or why not?
I would not. I think that the future is in world languages, yes, I agree, especially in Mandarin Chinese. You know, if we're going to reach a global economy and educate our students for the future, I think we really need to be open-minded about world languages. But I do not think we should go across the board in all of our elementary schools because similar to David's answer, what do you do in middle school? What do you do in high school? Let's suppose we have a world language in every one of our elementary schools. Who chooses the language? At Greer Elementary right now, just the kids that go to Greer, over 25 languages are spoken, maybe 30 languages. I'm not sure. I don't have the facts here, but I know it's at least 25 languages. So which one would we choose for Greer? Which one would we choose for the other schools? Okay, then you take all the schools that are doing all these different languages. They get to middle school. There are fewer middle schools. How many languages are we going to offer there? What will be the languages? It's just way too costly when they get to high school. You know, the standard is German, French, Spanish. you know, the funding's just not there. Then you have to look at all the money we'd have to spend in professional development to train the teachers, to bring in all these languages. And I want to step back just a second to, in my opinion, it's like the early child care. I know David said he supports it, but I don't think the money's there for that either, and not that it's not necessary. I think we need to move our necessary kids into the program of Bright Stars, but the money's not there, and there have also been so many studies done, and one of which, by the time the child gets to third grade, there is no difference in those kids who didn't. I'm thinking of the Head Start program, not Bright Stars, but there was no difference in those Head Start kids, the kids that had it and the kids who hadn't.
All right, we're to the last question from the host here. The topic is redistricting. We'll go first to Ms. Hatcher. Albemarle County Public Schools is currently considering many redistricting scenarios in order to provide relief for schools in the northern urban ring. If elected, how would you like to see the division address its capacity issues? Ms. Hatcher.
Well, this one is close to my heart. My two grandsons are in the Stony Point area, and Stony Point feeding into Albemarle High is one that's on the table. And my daughter-in-law made a couple of speeches at the redistricting meeting, and her point, of course, was her child or one of my grandsons is in band, and he cannot get the same band program at Monticello that he can at Albemarle High. But every parent that spoke had another reason. I just think that we've been doing short-term solutions and putting Band-Aids on the problem. I have recently been on the school board's long-range planning advisory committee, and I've learned that the problem goes way back. I mean, way, way, way back. And the problem is with capital improvements. We have known for a long time that a new high school or new schools are needed in the northern area, but nothing has been done about it. We haven't even band-aided some of those programs because on the list have been modernization programs, renovation programs, especially for Red Hill Elementary. If you've ever been there, you know that they are in bad need of a lot of improvements. Well, they've been bumped and bumped and bumped. And I think we need to find funding, and we need to find funding rather than put a Band-Aid on the situation. We need to look into alternative ways to fund things, bond referendums if that's needed or whatever. Looking at Albemarle High School, I need to say this really quick. The MESA program, it was designed for 200. Well, the max students would have been 200. There's 257 students in there now. Well, there's your 57 out of 100. I think there's little things that can be done to meet the needs of the high school. And one thing was announced today, which was the grandfathering.
Mr. Oberg. Albemarle County Public Schools is currently considering many redistricting scenarios in order to provide relief for schools in the northern urban ring. If elected, how would you like to see the division address its capacity issues?
I mentioned this in my opening statement, that I moved to Laurel Hills in Crozet specifically so my child would go to Crozet Elementary because I didn't want to get redistricted. That is an issue that is pivotal to a lot of parents, and whether it's rational or not, they do care. And this is one of the things, I think it's great that so many community members came out and testified regarding the redistricting. I wish that many parents would get so involved in everything else about the schools. But I think from a practical standpoint, we dropped the ball about 6 years ago when the economy was tanked and there was no work. Construction projects were cheap. We could have built a new high school back then and saved a tremendous amount of money, but we delayed it, and we keep delaying capital improvement projects. And what I can tell you is when I was a kid, my dad said you change the oil every 3,000 miles. And you listen to people who say, no, you don't really need to change the oil every 3,000 miles. And you can go, now I had somebody the other day told me I can go 10,000 miles without changing my oil. Well, you can, But that's a bad idea. You can put things off, but eventually you're going to pay for them. And what we're seeing now is the result of our pushing things down the road. And we knew that this growth was happening. We knew 6 years ago we were going to be in this spot. And we know now that 6 years from now, no matter what we do with redistricting, we're going to be right back in the same spot unless we deal with it from a systemic standpoint. We need to have effective, actual, long-term planning to deal with this issue so that we don't have every 5 or 6 years the same issue come over and over and over again. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to now go to your questions, and while those are coming up, I want to make sure you know about the upcoming candidate forums. Wednesday, October 14th, the League of Women Voters will be having the Whitehall and Samuel Miller candidates at Western Albemarle High School. So if you want to see these two and their Samuel Miller counterparts in action next Wednesday, you can do that. And then Thursday, October 29th, the at-large candidates, as well as the candidates in Ravana and Scottsville, will be at Monticello High School. And both those forums are at 7 p.m., hosted by the League of Women Voters. All right. Audience questions. We'll start first with Mr. Oberg. And the question is, if elected, what would be your top priority, Mr. Oberg?
My top priority is to make sure that our teachers are given the opportunity to be creative and professional in their classrooms. When I was in sixth grade, and I'm not happy about this, but I was a pain in the neck. I was a bright kid who was disruptive, and John Baldino knows this. I'm disruptive, and you guys, if you elect me, will find I say what I mean, whether people like it or not. And I was that way in sixth grade, and my sixth grade teacher took me aside, and she made me her class lawyer. And for 2 weeks in the middle of the year, she had me prepare a case against another student because he breached a contract with her. And then she brought in an actual judge, Judge Hornaday, came to our school, and we had a mock trial. Now, that is nowhere in the curriculum. That is nowhere in the lesson plans. But I guarantee you, this is something, and my high school, we were very tight together. When we got back together for our 25th anniversary, the 25th reunion, we all talked about how great that was. That was a lesson from sixth grade, and we all remembered caveat emptor, buyer beware. And that's what the judge, I won my case, and I became a lawyer. I strongly suspect that in a lot of schools around the Commonwealth of Virginia, if a teacher did that, she'd get fired. Because it's totally off the lesson plans, it totally derails the standards of learning. But that was incredible teaching. She should be rewarded for that. My priority is to make sure teachers have that opportunity. My child's gifted and talented teacher, Paula White, reached my child in ways that would never have occurred to me to reach her. I want to encourage that because my child blossomed, and I want that for every kid.
Thank you. Ms. Hatcher, if elected, what would be your top priority?
Well, I'd have to say the top priority is the students. And before all this exciting magic, I agree with David, the magic begins in the classroom and it ends in the classroom. And that teacher that is just fantastic or does creative things like that teaches lessons that are never forgotten. I used to teach economics, and I would do this thing with donuts, you know, and diminishing returns. They would all be hungry, and they'd all run for donuts. And after I'd say, eat more. Oh, no, you know, after number 10, they learned the concept. But in order to have this exciting stuff happen in the classroom, there has to be a classroom. And my top priority is to see that we budget. We do capital improvements that are so needed in this school district. There are so many schools that have just been let go for a while. You know, you push back, because maybe it's easier to just nix the capital improvements because the building's still standing and, you know, it's fine. The kids can come. The classrooms are still there. But there's so much disrepair. And the question's always about funding. Well, let's get creative on funding. Let's do some. Let's look back let's look at things that we've never even thought of. The state where I come from, Texas, all of the teachers' health care is bundled in with state employees. So all the health care is together with the state. I believe the health care in Virginia, it's all bundled separately. And so Albemarle County provides their health care, Augusta County theirs. If we would go statewide, maybe we'd have some of that money that's spent or matched by our school district. It could be spent for other things. And I think we just need to be creative about funding.
Thank you. All right, the second audience question, we'll start first with Ms. Hatcher. You are running for the Whitehall seat on the school board. What are your connections to the Whitehall schools and the community of Crozet? Ms. Hatcher.
Well, there's a correction right there. The community of Crozet is not the only community in the Whitehall district, and sometimes I really feel like poor old Earliesville, Free Union, and the small area of Whitehall gets neglected because everything is about Crozet. So it's not just the Crozet community. But one thing I want to do is I know delegates and some of our Virginia state reps, they have had town hall meetings. I've had a long career. I've got 40 years experience. I'm not working anymore. I would like to make this part-time job, which is school board, I would take it on as a full-time job. I would meet with my constituents. I would visit Crozet, Earliesville, Free Union, and Whitehall regularly, maybe something like office hours. We'd set up certain days in certain communities that we'd have meetings. But I think we need to go from the bottom up. We represent you. The parents know their children. You know what your children's needs are. You're the closest to the community. I think I need lots of feedback from the community. And so not only with Crozet, but with the four communities, I would want to have a lot of interaction, and I would have the time to do it. And I would love to do it. And that's one thing that I see as necessary. That's about all I have to say.
Thank you. Mr. Oberg, you are running for the Whitehall seat on the school board. What are your connections to the Whitehall schools and the community of Crozet? Mr. Oberg.
I've certainly been to every single one of the Whitehall schools multiple times. My daughter attended Crozet Elementary for 6 years and now attends Henley. So I'm a fixture. I was a fixture at Crozet. I intend to be a fixture at Henley. And if I'm elected, I'm going to be a fixture at Broaddus Wood and at Meriwether Lewis. I mean, Brownsville, rather. I'm a member of the Crozet United Methodist Church. I teach Sunday school there. I walked in the parade with John Baldino for the 4th of July parade. I shop at the local schools. Local schools, good grief, I apologize. I shop at the local stores. And my family lives here. I'm a community member. I've been here for 8 years. I picked Western Albemarle intentionally. I had been to pretty much every school around Central Virginia, and I specifically picked Western Albemarle for my child to go to high school. I picked Crozet Elementary because that's where I wanted to go to elementary school. I love it here. I can't imagine a nicer place to live in America. My wife and I picked this spot because I was leaving where I was, and she said, "Where do you want to move?" And I said, "Let's find out." So I Googled nicest place to live in America. This is true, 2007. And U.S. News and World Report and Forbes both listed Albemarle County as the nicest place to live in America. So we moved here. And God bless, it's been an incredible blessing for us. I love it here. We're going to be here for the rest of my life. And I hope it's a long one. And I hope I can serve the community in that way.
Great. Thank you. All right, the third audience question.
We'll go audience first. Questions are hard.
We'll go. First, Mr. Oberg, and this also relates to the theme of community. How can we promote and stress outreach by going into the community versus schools expecting families to come to the schools, i.e. parent-teacher conferences, meetings, programs, et cetera? So how can we promote and stress outreach by going into the community versus schools expecting families to come into the schools? Mr. Oberg.
There's a program that Orange County did, which I thought was amazing. And Orange County had a specific elementary school that was really struggling. And part of the reason they were struggling was there was no relationship between the community and the school. I mean, none. And so the principal said, you know what? We're going to go out to the people's homes. And if we did, if whenever they had parents who did not come to the parent council or parent teacher conferences, the teachers were tasked with going to the community homes and they'd go together. I think that was an amazing thing because it made a lot of the families who felt disconnected feel connected. They were invited. Please come to our. And what they did was they took an invitation to a barbecue. Now that seems simple and easy, and it was. And it also was incredibly effective. It brought people who had no relationship at all to the education system back into the school system, and it gave them the chance to trust the teachers, to trust the education system. I think we can do that. I also think it comes back to communication. The active parents with the PTOs and with the schools know exactly what's going on. And we have emails from the PATSO. I love the fact that I got an email probably three times a week from the Henley PATSO. But the reality is a lot of our parents don't have internet access at home. And sending an email, while it may be cheaper than sending home a piece of paper, doesn't get the information to them. We can do a better job making sure that we're reaching all of our families, not just the ones who, and I'm one of the people, I'm one of the privileged people. I get that. I'm blessed. I have internet access. Not everybody does, and I think we need to be aware of that.
Thank you. Ms. Hatcher, how can we promote and stress outreach by going into the community versus schools expecting families to come to the schools for parent-teacher conferences, meetings, programs, et cetera?
Okay, and my last question, I kind of answered that. I do plan to be very community-oriented and active and take things to the community rather than expect them always to come to us. One thing, one idea that I would love to see work is working with those community businesses from something as little as having a barbecue or a sandwich or an ice cream party or something at one of your local businesses to getting their funding for these big projects we have in school. I mean, you're going to flip when I tell you. Bell Telephone, I was able to get, this in the old days, I know that Bell Telephone was all we had. We didn't have Comcast and all the internet stuff and Xfinity and all. But I went to them and we wanted to teach technology and communications and stuff in a school. We had our schools in, we called them magnet schools, something like K-Tech, but except for our academies. You know, you'd have all the academies in one central area. That's another way we might could save money. But anyway, I got Bell Telephone to give us $1 million. This is when I worked for that media company. And that, I mean, that, you know, no one's going to, that's very hard to come by, I understand. And I was working in a huge, huge city. That was the city of Houston, greater than 4 million people right in the inner city. But things like that can be done. We've got to reach out and into the community and make them part of our schools, as well as, you know, bring more parents in. And certainly my friend Earl Smith in the audience, his pet peeve is, you know, people don't have the internet all over. They just don't. And we need to do something about that.
Thank you. Okay, we've got three more audience questions. The fourth one will go first to Ms. Hatcher. Would you support reducing the percentage of the school budget which goes to administration by reducing some of the positions in the administration or central office? Ms. Hatcher.
Well, I was one who always, I guess before I ran for a school board, I loved to say that, oh, my goodness, we're top-heavy in the administration. Well, I was thinking of other school districts and certainly the Department of Education. Usually you are top-heavy in administration, but I understand that Pam Moran has done some creative things lately, and we do not have as big of an administrative or downtown central office as we used to, because the magic is in the schools, and we need to have more magic happening in those classrooms with those teachers and spend that money for professional development or to bring in quality programs that are going to get our kids ready for the 21st century. And, you know, I think I would just give her a check plus and see where else we can eliminate some of these administrators. I don't know, you know, how many schools. I know at some of the schools that I was familiar with out west, there was like four or five assistant principals, and they were just so top-heavy. I'm not sure about that in our district, but I think when we should look into it and see what's going on, because that is certainly a way we could get the money back to the classroom where it counts and to the programs.
Thank you. Mr. Oberg, would you support reducing the percentage of the school budget which goes to administration by reducing some of the positions in the administration or central office? Mr. Oberg.
I'm not going to say yes to a blanket statement like that. Right now, 2% of our budget in Alamar County goes to administrators. It's a very small piece, so if you work at our budget at $160 million, that's $3.2 million. And that's not inconsequential, but if you fired all of the administrators, we'd still have a budget deficit of $3 million. I was in a position several years ago where they were talking about getting rid of some of the principals, and they were going to make Crozet Elementary have a half-time principal, and that principal was going to be shared with Red Hill. And I thought that was insane. You know, Crozet Elementary had an assistant principal. They don't anymore. CJ is right that Dr. Moran has done an exceptional job cleaning out a lot of the administration. We did not refit. Billy Hahn's position was a $160,000 budget line. They have not refilled that position. If you're asking me if I believe we can cut trim on the higher level, the federal level, yes. I think getting rid of the Secretary of Education was a great start. I hope they don't replace him. But I think in the Commonwealth of Virginia, and especially Admiral County, we've been very successful at monitoring that. Now, if I were in Charlottesville 10 years ago, I would say, yeah, there were a number of administration positions we could have cleaned out. Admiral County 6 or 7 years ago, there were some. And Dr. Moran did an exceptional job cleaning that out. They've reduced that expenditure. And so at this point, unless you could show me specific administrators that were not necessary, I would not be in favor of that. I think our high schools have the minimum number of assistant principals we need, and most of our elementary schools don't have assistant principals at all. So.
Thank you. The fifth audience question has to do with school nurses. And this will go first to Mr. Oberg. What is your position on nurses in our schools? And then there's a comment, nurses, especially substitute nurses, are not adequately paid. Substitutes only get $12 an hour gross pay. So, Mr. Oberg, what is your position on nurses in our schools?
As a parent of a child who got injured at school and got helped by a nurse, I'm glad she was there. I think our elementary schools and our high schools and our middle schools need nurses. I think $12 an hour is, I mean, if I were a nurse and somebody said I was going to pay you $12 an hour, I'd probably find that a little offensive. I think we can, as a community, we pay for a lot of things. We have some very nice libraries, and we have some very nice monuments, and we have some great parks. I would not support not having nurses in our schools so that we can justify other things.
Thank you. Ms. Hatcher, what is your position on nurses in our schools? Nurses, especially substitute nurses, are not adequately paid. Substitutes only get $12 an hour gross pay. Ms. Hatcher.
I've got to say ditto. I think a nurse is a professional with a degree, and they do a professional job and a job that's really, really needed. You spoke of your injury. My grandson broke his foot, you know, this was a while back, but if a nurse hadn't been there and known what to do, we would have been in big trouble. So I don't want to skim on nurses at all. I think we need to look, if I'm on the school board, I think we need to look and see what they are paid, then see if it's a comparable salary to what nurses are getting either at, you know, in the area. I know there is some discrepancy between UVA and Martha Jefferson on what is paid, but we really need to pay nurses correct, whether you're a substitute or you're there every day, or part-time or however they do. But I think we don't need to scrimp when it comes to that.
Thank you. All right, the last audience question. We'll go first to Ms. Hatcher. And just for the questioner in the audience, I've added a little piece on the end of it here. Hopefully you like it. Ms. Hatcher, how should school systems respond to requests for additional subject offerings, and I'll add, including new specialty centers? Ms. Hatcher.
How should who respond?
How should the school system respond to requests for additional subject offerings, including new specialty centers?
Okay, I'll go with the specialty center first. I'm all for that. I think we should probably lump our academies together, as I mentioned before. We have a wonderful plan for the Environmental Academy at Western, but I don't know if it's ever going to happen. And, and there's cost to all of these things. Maybe if we could lump them together like we did with K-Tech, it would be awesome for our students. But then again, we'd have to look at the buses and all of that. But I think that's one way we could spend money wisely. New offerings of subjects. This is really close to my heart. I was a social studies teacher for 10 years in high school. And I really, really, really believe social studies is one of the most important things that we teach. Of course, reading and, of course, math. But social studies is so important. And in the last 25 to 30 years, I have seen social studies just whittled, and whittled away. And in place of some of our American history and our civics, we have seen more multicultural social sciences. I'm all for that. You know, as a social studies teacher, I want those multicultural courses. I want to know everything we can know, but not in lieu of American history or some of our civics. They're not even required to take any part of economics anymore in most schools. It's just, so yes, let's add courses. I think that in the area of social studies, for example, we need to know it all. Let's not just not have multicultural social studies. Let's have that, plus let's have civics. Let's have all American history. I mean, it doesn't stop at World War II anymore. We've had a whole 50 more years, so yes.
Thank you. Mr. Oberg, how should the school system respond to requests for additional subject offerings, including new specialty centers? Mr. Oberg.
I think we should be open-minded to it. I wouldn't give a blanket yes, I think that course should be good, because some of the courses might not be. And it might be a situation where one student wants to study it and nobody else does. And I don't think we want to give a partial FTE, there's a partial, you know, part of a teacher's day to teach one student. However, the advent of the internet, and I'm not for distance learning outside of the classroom. However, our schools have the capacity at this point where we can teach long-distance classes. And I'm going to throw out a thing. I had a friend of mine in college who, at the time, it seemed really bizarre. He wanted to take Arabic. Now it seems less bizarre. But he wanted to take Arabic, and Washington University had one Arabic student, him. And the university said, we can't afford to do that. We can't have an Arab study program for one student. However, they did make a deal with the University of Chicago, which did have an Arab program, and he took it distance-wise. He took it, and it wasn't a correspondence course, but it was effectively a correspondence course. We can do that in our school systems. If we have students who have specific interests, I think there's probably somebody somewhere teaching that, and I think we should be open to that. I know there's a teacher at Western Admiral High School who wants to set up a recording studio and teach recording. And I asked him, I said, well, okay, explain to me how that benefits the students. And he said it teaches them math, it teaches them engineering, it teaches them music, it teaches them creativity. And I listened to him for about half an hour. I'm like, okay, get 15 students and I would support you. If you get 15 students to do that, I think he's right. That's a great way of teaching. I think we should be open-minded to it, but I wouldn't say that we should have every course.
Thank you. Great audience questions. Thank you for submitting those. All right, now you get to ask each other questions. We're going to start with Ms. Hatcher, and then we'll alternate. So you have a chance to ask Dave Oberg.
Do we answer our own questions, too? How does that work?
She will ask you a question that you answer.
I'll answer it.
Yep.
And then I'll answer
it. Okay. You can be a separate question. You could ask the same question if you
okay.
want to.
Okay.
Ms. Hatcher.
Okay, David. It's December of 2016. We have a new president. The president was just elected in November, and he's picked his cabinet. And you get a phone call, and he has, he or she, the new president has appointed you Secretary of Education, and you have accepted it. What would you do?
Objection. Assumes fact, not in evidence. I am completely unqualified for that position. There are going to be people. I told you, I say things people don't like. I don't know that there's anybody qualified for Secretary of Education. I think that there's a, and this comes from my small town background in Alaska. People in Washington, D.C. make a lot of rules that might make perfect sense where they are, but didn't make a whole lot of sense to people in Alaska. And Artie Duncan, the Secretary of Education who just stepped down, was the superintendent in Chicago. And he had a very firm grasp of what would and would not work in Chicago. And he assumed that all of those things were applicable to everybody else. And so he took those rules and tried to apply them. Well, I guarantee you they do not make sense here. And I actually wrote a letter to the Secretary of Education and asked him, would you come to our schools and explain to me how what you're doing applies here? Not only did he not come, I never got a response, which I thought was rude. So, CJ, if I were Secretary of Education, I would resign because I think I'm woefully unqualified.
Thank you. Mr. Oberg, you now get to ask Ms. Hatcher a question.
CJ, if you were Secretary of... No.
let me answer it.
You seem pretty confident that the budgetary process... I don't know how to ask this. I heard you say a couple of times things like, we have enough money, it's not about getting more money, but we have a deficit for next year of $6.5 million, and in 5 years we're going to have an additional 600 students. And so I get that there might be a mechanism to get outside money and corporate money, but if put in a position of either cutting programs or advocating for an increased tax rate, what would you do?
Well, we always hear that there's a budget gap every time this time of year, and somehow they figure it out by March. I don't think I'm naive in this. I think there is money that can be spent in a more judicious way. Now, granted, if you want to throw money at me, or if the Board of Supervisors decided to increase property tax and we can have more money to the school district, there's plenty of ways to spend it. I can't specifically answer that because I don't have any of the facts and figures, but I really wonder why every time this year there's a budget gap, and then when the budget is due, it all works itself out magically. I do think there are budget problems, and I think the members on the Board of Supervisors don't really realize, because it's not presented in such a way, as to, you know, how we're going to line item, how we're going to use everything. I guess I'm very conservative when it comes to money, and I really think that we could be doing a much better job.
Thank you. All right. Ms. Hatcher, you get to ask the next question.
Oh, gosh.
It's hard.
Okay. Let me just... Woodrow Wilson is one of the presidents from the state of Virginia who is, by some groups, held in high regard because he is one of our presidents. Virginia seems to have more presidents than any other state. I always used to tell the students, I held him in high regard in that he was dyslexic. And he was our first president to have a PhD. And he was dyslexic. But he was very progressive, and he had a lot of programs besides the League of Nations, which, you know, in later years became the United Nations. you know, our Virginia kids learn Virginia history, and so I'm really not trying to nail you or put you on the spot. But what are there, is there any other thing that you're familiar with about Woodrow Wilson that you would say he did a good job at?
I think Woodrow Wilson had a very optimistic attitude. Now, whether it's realistic or not, you can argue. Woodrow Wilson had the perspective of we can fix everything through legislation, through programs, and I would love it if that were true. I don't think history played out the way Woodrow Wilson anticipated that it would. I think his optimism, while infectious, was probably misplaced in a lot of ways. But, you know, like you say, I respect the fact that he was the president. I respect the decisions the popular vote made at that point. And I wish he was right. I truly do. I wish the world were the way Woodrow Wilson thought it could be. I'm a Generation Xer. I've been told we're sort of cynical. I don't know that the world is exactly the way Woodrow Wilson would have designed it.
Okay.
Fair?
Thank you. Mr. Oberg, you get to ask the last question.
And what's the most challenging part of this process for you?
Oh, my goodness. I guess it's getting home really late and, you know, just being busier than I ever thought I would. I guess that's been somewhat challenging because I still meet my grandkids and take one to soccer and pick up one from band and just working it all in. But I could hardly talk because I know you have a real job or a day job. Most challenging, I don't know, fun has been meeting people when I go door knocking. I have had a lot of, I've had an experience that I never thought I would have. I mean, it's been fun, interesting. I just had visions of people slamming the door and, you know, not wanting to talk to me or, and it hadn't been that way. You know, for the most part, when they answered the door, of course, a lot of them don't. Maybe they're hiding behind the curtain. I don't know. But when they do answer the door and they talk to me, it's been very enjoyable. And I guess the challenging part of that is just getting me to get out the door, to get in the car, to go do the door knocking. Anyway, it's been fun.
Thank you. Good job. I'm so glad when I ran for school board, we didn't have this going on.
Thanks a lot, Brian.
I don't want to get stumped by the history teacher. All right. Closing statements. You'll each get 3 minutes, and we're going to wrap up the forum tonight. Ms. Hatcher gets to go first, and then Dave Oberg. Ms. Hatcher.
Okay. I'm excited to be here. I've had a lot of fun with the process. I want to thank everybody for coming tonight again. I just want to say that children are our greatest resource. I love my grandkids. I've watched them grow up, and I've thought, then there's been times when I thought, oh, my goodness, you know, if I could only make the world perfect for you. And I think the answer to that is a successful life. We want our kids to have a successful life. And they're only going to be successful if they have a quality education. And for that to be achieved, I think decisions have to be made in the local area, with the local school board, with the state. Keep the federal government out of it. If I could have answered the same question I asked David, I would have said on day one, I would have accepted the position of Secretary of Education, and on day one, I would have eliminated the whole thing. And that money would be divided 50 ways to the 50 states. All the money that paid for that huge bureaucracy, divided. It's there. It's in the federal budget. Divide it up and send it out, and every state would get that money, and I'd go home, and there'd be no more Department of Education. I just think it's so important to do things locally. If I'm elected, I'm going to put students first. I have the time. I have the talent. I have the energy to meet the demands of the office. I don't have another job, as I've said. I'm retired. I'm excited about doing it. I think back to what I've been saying all night, the biggest problem is funding. And I tell you, I've got lots of ideas. I think we can be a lot more creative. And so if elected, I will do the best I can to find that money for you, or I'll eat my hat.
Thank you. Mr. Hoberg, you have 3 minutes for your closing statement.
I started this process at the beginning of the summer. I was at the Crozet Fire Department barbecue, and I sat down. I was trying to get signatures to run. And V.L. James, I don't know if any of you know V.L. James, but he's a salt-of-the-earth kind of guy, looked at me like I was insane. He said, "Why would you want to do that?" And I've had that question a lot over the past 5 months, and my answer is the same. It's because I believe it's important. I believe it's my responsibility as a citizen, and I'm sure CJ agrees with this. As a citizen, my job is to give back to the community. I've been extraordinarily blessed in my life. I've been given lots of opportunities, and I think it's my obligation. This sounds cheesy, but it's true. I'm a real patriot. I believe the American system of government is awesome, but I think it only works if we're committed to it. And sometimes you've got to put your money where your mouth is. And I've sat on the sidelines for a lot of years, and at some point it's time to pony up. And I think it's my opportunity, my responsibility to step up and serve my community if you want me. If I'm elected, I will spend every single moment I have working for our kids to give them every opportunity to help them to succeed. I hope you will vote for me. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let's give these two candidates a round of applause. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Again, if you have any questions for Charlotte till tomorrow, the League of Women Voters, or the Daily Progress, we'd be happy to speak with you afterwards. Thanks for coming.